Pleasure to welcome Martin Wolf. Martin's had a very distinguished career as an economist, first in the World Bank, then in something called the Trade Policy Research Centre that operated here in London. But then, of course, he's known to everyone here, I'm sure, from his writings in the Financial Times. And they're really some of the most incisive, interesting, and important writing that goes on in the FT, I think. Anyway, I believe this is the occasion of the launch of the paperback version of the globalization book. So the book came out some months ago and was enormously well received, as I'm sure you all know. Anyway, a paperback version is now available. But with that, let me just welcome Martin again. And he'll speak for 45 minutes or so, and then there'll be 20 minutes or so for questions afterwards. So, Martin.
Thank you very much.
I was astonished to discover as I came in that there was at least a very large number of people queuing outside waiting to come in and to hear me. And I thought to myself, the LSE really is a very, very peculiar place, because that's certainly the sort of treatment I wouldn't expect anywhere else in the world. And I suspect it shows there's something quite seriously wrong with all of you, that this is the highest priority thing you can find to do at 6:30 on an afternoon. I'd like to go and have a drink myself. Anyway, as Tony was kind enough to point out, this lecture was occasioned by the launch of the paperback, and that says one thing at least, which is that the hardback has sold a lot of copies, more, I think, than the publisher expected, and that's very encouraging for them and even more encouraging for me. The paperback is fantastically cheap. I think it's $9.99. So if you haven't read it in hardback, and even if you have, why don't you go and buy it? I'd be very grateful. And if anybody has bought a copy and has it here, I will be happy to sign it. And this may well reduce its value, I know. But anyway. Now, to explain, as Tony pointed out, I have the great advantages of not being an academic. I've never been an academic, which I consider a badge of some pride. I work very hard not to become an academic, and the result is I don't have to write books which are intensely academic in nature. There are no equations in the book. Some of the words are long, but I think it's reasonably clear. It is addressed at a relatively sophisticated audience, in other words, people like you, and it is about what I simply think is, and it presents a very clear point of view. Everybody who reads my writing knows what my point of view is, on what I think is one of the great issues of our time, namely the nature of international economic integration, its implications, and its future. I think it presents a particular point of view, what I would describe as a broadly liberal one in the classical sense, without being too fanatical, recognizing the difficulties with it and the problems. And I believe it is also fairly solidly based on the economic literature. So by and large, I think I remain of the view that it makes a valuable and important contribution. And fortunately for me, a few people have agreed on this. And even better, we've been able to quote them on the back of the paperback. Now, let me just say, this is a large book, it's about 400 pages, and I cannot cover all the subjects, or indeed most of them tonight. So what I will do is just cover five aspects of this book and this argument, five big themes. The first is what we should think globalization is. There's a lot of debate on this. I'll come to this in a moment. Some of it emanates from this parts of this place, and I think a lot of it is desperately confused. So I want to just say at least what I think globalization is about. The second point I want to make, it's a very big theme of the book, is the role of states. This is a subject I've thought about and written about a lot more since then, and there's some things I would have liked to add. I apologize if you can't see the screen, but I have no control or responsibility for the technical side of this lecture. That's just how it is, I'm afraid. Anyway, the second issue that I want to discuss is the role of states, the central role states play in making globalization work, and I'll try and explain what I mean by that. I'm going to discuss very briefly one aspect of globalization's impact on the world, which is globalization and poverty, which is an aspect of the record And in that context, I want to discuss what seems to me the most interesting feature of the process of international economic integration, which is that it has coincided with and been driven by, in fundamental ways, the rise of Asia. And looking around this audience, I don't think it would be terribly difficult for you to understand the significance of that. The fourth issue I'm going to talk about very briefly is, again, some arguments that have come from the LSE, particularly from John Gray, whom many of you will know, which is about, is globalization consistent with a welfare state? And I take a very strong view. I have a very long chapter in the book which argues that it's completely consistent with having a welfare state. And finally, I'm going to discuss what I think are the threats to globalization. Is this sort of system going to last? And I'll try and get through this in the next 45 minutes or so. It'll be quick, but I hope that will lead you to raise questions and we can debate some of these issues. As I said, it only covers a small part of what's in the book, but that's the best I can do in the time. I define globalization as an economist, namely it's the integration of economies through markets across frontiers. There are lots of people who think of it as the great social process of our time, the great political process of our time, as some sort of overarching model for the entire world. I accept fully that there are very profound implications of a globalization process, social and political, upon a globalization process. But it seems to me that we must start with the process that is driving it all. And what is essentially driving it is an economic process, namely integration of economies through markets internationally. There are essentially two forces driving this, one of which is consistent and continuous and has been so for many, many centuries, but has been particularly rapid, of course, since the Industrial Revolution, the last two centuries, which is a series of radical technological change which are reducing or have reduced the costs of transport and communications. And as I will show in a very simple chart, the speed of these things have varied over this time. Even if you look at the 20th century, what's quite interesting about the last 30 years, and I think it shapes a lot of the characteristic of this particular phase of globalization, is that it's the cost of communications that has collapsed. The costs of transport, in fact, have fallen, as far as we can see, very, very little in the last 30 years. And what's more, there has been no fundamental breakthrough in transport technology since civil aviation, which is really a very old technology now. But communications, as of course you all understand, has basically fallen to a marginal cost of zero. And it has a very profound implications for the organization of production systems, and particularly the nature of multinational companies in there, on the one hand, and financial markets on the other. The other process, however, is an economic policy process, namely the process of liberalization. That process is often seen by international economists as a process of liberalization at the border. But of course, in almost all cases, and fundamentally, processes of liberalization at the border tend to coincide with wider processes of liberalization of economies, moves towards the market. And as I will indicate to you, but I just state the obvious, we all know that this is the case. Over the last 25 years, initiating really in the late 70s, there has been a worldwide shared movement towards a greater degree, and I stress a greater degree of reliance on market processes and greater liberalization of the frontier in pretty well every economy on earth, and including in particular a number of giants, of which the most important are, of course, China, India, and the former Soviet Union. And that revolution is the principal driver of what we sometimes call the second wave of globalization, the first wave being the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And that's, again, as I said, what globalization has meant. As I said, I would just give you a few charts. These are probably impossible to read from here, so let me just give you these just show the unit costs of transport and communications in three aspects over the 20th century. And the blue line, which I hope you can see, is ocean freight. The purple line is air freight. And the green line is basically international telephony. And it brings out the point I'm making. Purple and these basically have stabilized in the last 30 years. And in fact, ocean freight costs seem to have been rising a bit. There's a lot of debate about this. It doesn't really matter. But essentially, they've stabilized. What has, however, in the thing in which there's been an unbelievably large revolution is the cost of communication, which have fallen from really very high levels to nothing. I like to point out to people that, you know, most of you are, I suspect, a little bit younger than I am. I can remember a time when very, very, very well, when I first went to the United States in the 1970s, where I lived for 10 years, and I worked for an institution which paid people probably rather too much. Nonetheless, I thought very, very carefully before making any transatlantic phone calls. These were seen as penally expensive. Now I think most of you would consider this is just about the cheapest thing you ever do. Now, and that affects everything we do, and it affects the whole process. The second thing, as I said, is liberalization. I've just taken one nice little indicator, which is the average tariff rate in China. China has essentially moved from a country which had penal barriers at the border just 12 years ago to a country whose trade policies are effectively as liberal and in many ways more liberal than those of developed countries. In agriculture, in fact, China's policies are clearly more liberal than those of developed countries, one of the consequences of the WTO accession. China is extreme because it's so large and because liberalization has been so radical. But if you look to pretty well any other developing country, you get a pattern quite similar to that. India's doesn't look so different, except everything is about 30 percentage points higher. But it's essentially the same pattern. It's an extraordinarily swift liberalization process. And this has driven an extraordinarily rapid and universal increase in trade intensity. This is a chart which shows 1990 is the blue column, and 2002 is the purple column, and it shows ratios of trading goods to goods GDP. So it's actually a fairly straightforward ratio of trading goods and the countries, which you probably can't see, just to indicate that it's Thailand, Germany, Mexico, UK, Turkey, China, US, and Japan. So a reasonable cross-section of big developed countries and big developing countries. And you'll see that all of them have experienced, all of them, all without exception, a very big rise in trade ratios. China has a higher ratio of trading goods to GDP today, considerably higher, and in fact it's risen further since 2002 than either the US or Japan. Thailand is higher than Germany. So this is a universal phenomenon. This is what globalization really means. And this is another, I think, even more revealing chart in some ways, because it brings in the role of multinational investment. And it's a chart which I've taken from the United Nations World Investment Report, just to indicate it. The blue is 1982, the 1990 is purple, and 2003 is yellow. And in each case, the denominator is global GDP, just as uniform. This is the size of the inward stock of FDI in the world. This is 1990, this is 2003. So it's increased 2.5 times faster than global GDP. This is sales by foreign affiliates, gross sales by foreign affiliates. Again, they've increased twice as fast as GDP. Exports by foreign affiliates have increased about 50% faster than world GDP. Exports of goods and services, of course, have also risen, but in fact more slowly than the things associated with multinational investment. The gross product of the foreign affiliates, namely the value added, has increased about 50% faster than GDP. So we've seen, again, not only in trade, as I've indicated to you already, but an extraordinary increase in the penetration of the multinational business across the world in scale. It's not uniform, but in scale. So that is the first thing I wanted to bring out. This is what globalization means. This is what's happened. There has been an extraordinarily rapid and really worldwide increase in activities that are oriented towards the world market. I could have given you much more data, but that, I think, is the underpinning of what we think has been going on. Now, the second theme, as I said, I wanted to talk about, which is a central theme of my book, is the relationship between markets and states. And I make the point at great length, and I think it's a very important point that many people on my side of the debate, if you like, very broadly have tended to ignore and understate, is the absolutely central role, indispensable role, that state systems, the system of the state, plays in making any sort of market economic system of any kind work.
you need at the very least, and people can argue at great length about how much more you need, but you clearly need a state system that provides personal security, some fundamental property rights so people have at least a reasonable degree of ability to plan, some basic social services so the population are reasonably healthy and reasonably well educated, and basic infrastructure. If you don't have that, you can't play in this game. You can't play at all. You can't, in fact, have an economy that functions. And it is becoming increasingly obvious, for reasons I've written about a lot recently, that unfortunately quite large parts of the world don't have those necessary conditions. Essentially, this brings us back to the history of thinking about the state. In the UK context, of course, and that goes very much back to the 17th century. That was the period when this debate was most intense here. We're thinking, of course, about Hobbes and Locke. And at least a few things we would all agree on. A state to function needs an effective monopoly of coercive power. Even a libertarian like Nozick agreed on that. It has to use that, however, for the benefit of the population at large, not just for the benefits of the ruling elite. In other words, what we need is some reasonably effective service states, states that use this monopoly effectively for the benefits, at least of the large part of the population, rather than using it in the natural way. And I do stress it's the natural way. The more I think about it, the more obvious it is that nothing is less surprising than the fact that people who control a state, who have a monopoly of coercive power of a state, use it for their own benefit. That is, after all, if you think about history, the main reason people have ever had to want to own a state. And so it's not terribly surprising. The anomalies, in fact, historically, and to some degree even today, though less so, fortunately, are the states that actually function to some degree in the interests of the people. Certainly the achievement is rare. And far more common in history, and as I said, and still frequent today, are predatory, weak, or failing states. And, of course, as I again argued yesterday, there are a very close relationship between them. We've discovered now on many occasions that when predatory regimes collapse, it often leaves, because of the disintegrating effect on civil society of their activities, it actually leaves very weak or failing states. They're actually almost twin sisters. Today, just to give you an indication of the scale of this problem, a recent report from DFID, Department for International Development, argued that there are about 46 states with 900 million inhabitants, so that's a sixth of the world, which are in a very fragile state. And I think the World Bank's analysis, which suggests that about 30 states, which is a sixth of all the states in the world with 500 million inhabitants, simply are close to or actually are dysfunctional. Now, how do we get good states? Well, it turns out, actually, and something I think we've learned very clearly, that it's very, very hard. If you look at the history of the evolution of contemporary democracies, say, in Europe, quite apart from the obvious fact that wealth helps, there's a lot of evidence for that, and that goes almost without saying, you need quite a lot of external regulatory competition to motivate governments to improve policies. It's required deep constitutional changes, and also deep reforms of values, particularly in public service. The creation of a working, functioning, reasonably honest and effective bureaucracy and legal system is an astonishing but also essential achievement. And obviously, to make all that work, you need resources. Most of the weak states are poor states. Well, they all are. And so we have, and I argue this at some length, a real vicious circle at work in large parts of the world. The list is very long. I think you can all think of them, of places where extreme poverty creates very weak states. Weak states are unable to provide any of the services that are needed. This creates further poverty, and we have the most terrible, vicious circle. And it is, in my view, I argue in this book, the biggest development challenge we have today in the world is to find some solution to this. Now let me just go to my third theme. How much globalization, what is the record? How much globalization is there, and what is the record? And I'll just discuss one aspect of this which seems to me central and exciting and important, and that is, above all, the rise of Asia. Well, what we know, and I think it's very relevant to where the globalization has worked and where it's not, is that if you think of the markets and the degree to which they're integrated, on any criteria you care to use, labour markets are less integrated today than they were a century ago. And this is shown both by the much lower flows of people across the world in proportion to world's population. In the late 19th century, about 10% of the world's population seems to have moved to a country different from the one in which it was born. And today, on the latest data from the Institute of Migration, IOM, is that it's about 3%. But more important, of course, as you know very well, the differences in real wages across the world, which is a pretty good indication of market disintegration, are greater now than they've ever been in history. So it's pretty clear labour markets are extremely disintegrated. Capital markets, at the short end, are clearly very integrated, but they have a very disturbing feature, which I again discuss at some length, but I'm not going to say more about now, is that they have been very, very poor at generating net movements on a stable basis from rich to poor countries. In fact, as I'm sure you know, the net flow of capital in the world over the last 7 or 8 years has been from poor countries to rich countries in aggregate, and above all, from everyone to the United States. And that's a very peculiar phenomenon. It has very big costs for those countries which are naturally quite dependent on imported capital, i.e. those countries with very relatively low savings rates. And that's, I think, a very important reason for this longer-term difficulties of Latin America, in which a continent in which almost all countries have extremely low savings rates compared with Asia, and therefore have historically, and by historically I mean over a century or more, very dependent on foreign capital, which hasn't worked very well. The area where things clearly have worked sensationally well are in production and trade, as I've shown, and basically because of the way technology, particularly communications, has integrated with the liberalization process. And it's turned out to be sensationally favorable to one class of countries, which has consistently been the most successful of the developing countries in the last half century, and that is labor surplus developing countries. These have been the winners in the development race because of their ability to exploit this. And it so happens that the countries which have all started with that basic condition to an exceptional degree are those of East Asia, and to a lesser degree now beginning to come through in South Asia, partly because policy has been so bad, but India's development has clearly shown that. So what we have seen is the Asian story, and the Asian story comes from the unique favorable opportunities created by this sort of world economic system for countries with very large quantities of surplus labor. And of course, the biggest winner of all in this period has been China. So I put up, if you can read it, the most famous comment ever made by a European about China. And if you can't read it, what it says is, "Let China sleep, for when she wakes, she will shake the world." And that's where we are now. To just indicate the significance of this Asian story, and the recovery of Asia, I put up this chart, which I've taken from the work of Angus Maddison on GDP at PPP. These are, of course, we all know, heroic numbers, but it basically shows a very clear picture of the decline and rise of Asia. In 1820, when GDP per head in the world certainly didn't vary more than 3 or 4 to 1 between the richest and poorest places, China, which had about a third of the world's population, also generated probably about a third of the world's output at purchasing power parity. India generated another 16%, and Asia as a whole probably generated about 60%, roughly in line with its share of world population. By the way, East and South Asia has a slightly lower share of world's population today than it did in 1820, because of the growth of Latin America and Africa over that period. Today, it's a little over 50%. It remains the case, however, as I like to point out in these lectures, that essentially humanity is Asian. The decline of Asia in the 19th and early 20th century was extremely severe because there was essentially no growth, and it reached its nadir in the mid-20th century when, according to Maddison's data, the total share was about less than 20% of GDP, and China had shrunk to almost negligible levels, and India ditto. In the 50 to 73 period, we had the great recovery of Japan. And by 73, Japan was as big as an economy. And remember, I'm doing this at purchasing power parity, so that expands the GDP of these very populous countries. But in 1973, Japan was as big as China and India put together. The last 25 years have been the years of China and, to a lesser degree, India. Today, it's probably its share, there are various estimates, somewhere between 12 and 15% of world GDP. It's the second largest economy in the world of PPP. India's about 5, so it's less than half the size of India. Japan is shrinking. The rest of Asia is together now back up to 40. As I've argued on many occasions, this is the great economic story of our lifetimes and is intimately related to, I know you can't read this, so I'll explain this, it's intimately related to the way the global economic system has been favourable towards those with a particular set of factors of production of the Asian developing countries. This, I'm not going to go through all of this. I know it's rather difficult to read, though, the chart that this table is in the book. But I've just taken the main point. If you look between 73 and 2001, which most people would think of as the globalization era, the one area of the world that has grown faster than between 50 and 73 and has really grown very fast is Asia, excluding Japan, growing about 3.6% a year in GDP per head. GDP per head is growing 3.6%. Latin America about 1%, partly because the 80s were lost, it was better than the 90s, but still not very good. The Africa is essentially stagnant. So this is, if you look at the development process, this is essentially the story of the Asian giants, and much less so of the other regions of the world. And what has that done to world poverty? Well, essentially it's done exactly what you'd expect from this growth performance. Namely, these are World Bank figures, fairly standard World Bank figures, on GDP, on people on less than a dollar a day at PPP. It's a convenient metric. It has lots of problems, but it's a convenient metric. Essentially what they show, and these figures are really quite startling, is that if you take the East Asia and Pacific region, the number of people in that state, they argue, fell from 770 million to 280 million in just 20 years. This is the largest absolute and proportional decline in mass poverty in any region in history. South Asia, much smaller decline, sub-Saharan Africa, inverse, has doubled, and nearly all the people who live in extreme destitution in the world are in one of those three regions. They're either in East Asia, they're all in sub-Saharan Africa or South Asia. That level of poverty is relatively rare in other regions. It exists, but it's much rarer. And in terms of proportions of populations, the East Asian story is unbelievable in some ways. Over that 20-year period, it's fallen from 56% of the population on less than a dollar a day to just 16%. And on the latest UN projections for the Millennium Development Goals, they are basically arguing that this form of extreme destitution, subsistence minimum, will have disappeared from East Asia and Pacific within the next 10 to 15 years. South Asia has actually had a pretty big decline in the proportion. The reason it hasn't in absolute numbers is population has been growing very rapidly. That's also relevant to sub-Saharan Africa because the shares have remained pretty constant, but the population has doubled. And that, of course, is related to a different phenomenon from the globalization story, which is, in fact, the poorer the country, the faster the population has grown. But anyway, the basic story underlines what I've said. The countries that have managed to exploit these opportunities, predominantly Asian labor surplus countries, have done sensationally well, and those that haven't, haven't. Now let me go to my fourth theme, very different one. There is a big debate in the developed countries, which basically says, well, this globalization is all very well, but if you're on the left, it's going to mean the end of the welfare state. We won't be able to tax, we won't be able to provide benefits to anybody, and it'll all be savage Anglo-Saxon capitalism, and that's awful. And then there are many on the right who agree with them completely, except that they say that's wonderful. And what I say is they're both completely wrong. It is perfectly possible, and the record supports this, to sustain high taxes, provided some factors of production are relatively taxable, or the taxes go to produce valuable amenities that can only be consumed by those who are present. In other words, either there must be factors of production that can't move very easily, and I will argue very strongly there are, or if they can move, the tax bundle provides them with amenities that actually is very attractive to them. Or as I put it in a book, if you want to live in Sweden and enjoy the pleasures of Swedish society, you can't live in New Jersey. And this is quite important because a lot of people do want to live in Sweden, and most of them are Swedish. Now, very important. That's why Sweden is so rich. It's still easy to tax people and capital provided a bundle of valuable amenities are provided. I'm afraid this is illegible. So So, but I'll just I'll read it to you. It's the quote from the John Gray's book on Thulsdoorn, which I use as the basis for this argument. I disagree with him, but that's the debate. What he says is, sovereign states are waging a war of competitive deregulation forced on them by the global free market. A mechanism of downward harmonization of market economies is in operation. Every type of currently existing capitalism is thrown into the melting pot. In this contest, the socially dislocated American free market possesses powerful advantages. So it is the end of civilization as we know it. And so what I'm going to show is actually the evidence on this is, at least, the chapter is very long. It goes through many, many arguments on this and shows, I hope it shows that the arguments are very weak in all aspects. But I'll just focus on one aspect. Is it true that we can see in some clear way that it's impossible to sustain high taxes and, above all, differential tax rates across developed countries, all of which are very open, all of which allow completely free movement of capital, all of which effectively allow completely free emigration? And the evidence is quite clear. Yes, it is. The share of revenue has risen everywhere. In 2002, there's no significant developed country except Germany, and even there it's very marginal, which has a lower tax ratio than in 1980. And don't forget, the 80 to 2002 period really does capture the globalization integration period. It was a period, for example, in which all the European countries abolished all their exchange controls, so that was a very important change. And there is no sign of a huge capital outflow or outflows of skilled labor from high-tax Europe. On the contrary, Europe is a net importer of skilled labor, and it is pretty well in balance on capital outflows. Again, I think you probably won't be able to read this, but let me just indicate what it says. It shows tax receipts as a share of GDP, overall tax receipts, in the major OECD countries, US, Japan, Germany, France, Italy, UK, Canada, Denmark, Sweden, Australia, the average for the EU15, for 65, 18, 19, 2002, and here I just take the difference between 65 and 2002, but I could have done the same roughly for the later period. There are some countries which have had modest reductions in the last period, but over the whole period, there's clearly been a very rapid rise in the tax ratio, and there are quite a lot of countries which continue to have very high tax ratios in 2002, many of them higher than even in 1990. The variation from the US on 26% to Sweden on 50% is 2-1, and yet, as I'm sure you all know, Sweden has been among the most successful economies of the last 10 years. There hasn't been no general capital flight and no general labour flight from Sweden. And the reason, of course, is that the Swedish government uses the money to provide sets of amenities which the Swedes value. If you live in Sweden, it really is pretty difficult to avoid the taxation. Even on capital income, if you're going to spend it, it will be visible. So it really is not that difficult to sustain the welfare state structure. It's pretty clear to me that these are a function of domestic choices. Of course, with higher taxes, net of tax, income to the householder is lower, but this is compensated by various location-specific benefits. Interestingly, even corporation tax, now there's an incidence question here, so there's a lot of debate about the significance of who bears corporation tax. I could have given others. But even in corporation tax, again, there's a fantastic variation across countries, from a very high rate of corporation tax in Australia down to very low levels in Germany. Germany, by the way, which has a very high marginal corporation tax, probably has the most inefficient corporation tax in the world, and very well known because of all the allowances. But essentially, you've got incredible variation. You have quite a number of countries which have been able to increase their corporate tax receipts without huge difficulty, even though corporations are, in theory, extremely mobile. And the reason is, of course, is that actually corporations are much less mobile than you think, and it is perfectly possible to continue to tax them. Now I'm sorry I'm going through this quickly, but basically the point I wanted to make there, and I discussed this at much greater length, is that the arguments about the welfare state and globalization are enormously exaggerated, and provided the state operates in a reasonably effective way, uses the money in ways that do not destroy the economy, which support activities in the economy, or provide things that people welcome if they live there, there doesn't seem to be any great difficulty in sustaining these divergences. There are, of course, we now know some countries in Europe that have had, continental Europe, that have had economic problems, but countries with much higher tax ratios have avoided them. And essentially, I think the difference is between the nature of the policies, the way particularly regulatory systems work. Now let me discuss, if I may, the last theme of my presentation today, which really concerns my last chapter, which is I've discussed globalization, what it is, what it depends on, the state, some of its implications, who's done well out of it and who hasn't. I've discussed the welfare state. Now let me discuss what I think is the last and in a way the biggest question, which is it going to last? And the reason that's an important question, quite apart from the fact that I think it's a valuable process, is that, as you all know, a very rapid growth in international economic integration did occur in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. This was completely smashed in the first half of the 20th century, where almost everything that could go wrong did. And it's natural to ask yourself whether that sort of process can be repeated, and that's what I would like to discuss in these last minutes. If we think about what drove that, the first and incomparably the most important process I've just described as insecurity is essentially global political disintegration, the two world wars and everything those world wars brought about in terms of the relationships among states and the working of any economic system. The second, not independent of that, is what I call instability, which I mean economic instability, and of course the most important event in that regard, indeed the most important event of that type that has ever occurred, was the Great Depression of the 1930s, which essentially destroyed completely the integrated economic system. The third, which was interacted very significantly with that process of economic instability, was protectionist interests, which came to the fore very powerfully, particularly in the United States, in the 1930s, 20s and 30s, and above all in the very famous Smoot-Hawley Tariff of 1930, which raised US protection to historically unprecedented levels. And given the role of the United States then as the principal creditor nation, that swiftly led to replication in the rest of the world, and the rise of protection was extraordinary. And the final factor, which I discuss at great length, was the role of ideas in all this, in particular the rise in the late 19th and a rapid further rise in the 20th centuries of essentially a whole wave of anti-market ideas, pro-planning. There's a whole history, obviously, to why national planning became so popular. It goes back, I think, essentially to the First World War, then copied by the Soviet Union under Stalin and further copied then throughout most of the world. Protectionist ideas and so forth. These were all very powerful. And the question I'd like to ask is, can we see this sort of set of forces or some of them recurring? First, insecurity. We had huge conflicts among the great powers, and that led to two world wars, as I've already pointed out. And today we have, of course, the fear of terrorism, though the great powers are on the same side, at least for the moment. I just want to emphasize that I do think the terrorist issue is a very significant one for globalization. It's very significant for many reasons, but it seems to me pretty obvious that if you did imagine someone succeeding in letting off an effective nuclear device in a container in some major port, that trade would stop pretty fast. Pretty damn fast. And if we actually had to be sure, if any country said, we need to be certain that no such thing is present in any container moving into our ports, given that there are tens of millions of them moving around the world in any year, we would have a pretty big problem. So if a terrorist group wants to make a mess of the world's economy, it wouldn't be fantastically difficult. In addition to that, that's what I call mega-terrorism, we are in the process of two, I think, associated upheavals in the world economy, which also have enormous geopolitical significance, whether we like it or not. We are watching, as I argued in a piece I wrote, published on Wednesday, we are watching this historic transformation in relative power, associated above all, of course, with the rise of China. And associated with that, of course, is a completely different set of demands for world resources. And the most important of those is, of course, energy. Now, historically, that's the sort of thing that we can make a real mess of an international system. It's not terribly difficult if you read what many Americans, particularly those present close to the present administration, are saying about China. It really isn't very hard to see very serious and severe geostrategic competition, rivalry, and tension between China and the US over the next two or three decades. And since they're so economically integrated, that will create a big mess, just as the First World War did. I tend to take the view that because of the nuclear weaponry and the danger associated with nuclear war, that these we will do a much better job of handling those tensions than was done 100 years ago. But my confidence is not absolute. And if you want to ask what will really end the world as we know it, that seems to me the simplest possible explanation or answer. There's obviously a big question about oil supplies and what they're going to be replaced by. The resource needs of Asian industrialization are, of course, enormous. At least, but somewhere between a half and two-thirds of the global incremental demand for energy is now from Asia. China is a much bigger factor at the margin than the US. And I sort of wonder, real prices of oil, by the way, today are higher than they were after the first oil shock, so they have gone to a very high level. This is where we are now against the first oil shock. I sort of wonder when some noodle in the United States is going to say, we provide the security, or at least all the military forces for the Gulf. We're doing so in order to provide everybody in the world with oil, plentiful and cheap. Why don't we take it all for ourselves? So that's the geostrategic threat. Instability. We've had the Great Depression, as I said, in the 30s. We now have had a long series of financial crises. We have had some fairly impressive asset price bubbles, and we now have a pretty big tension associated with the dollar and global imbalances. I tend to be a modest optimist on this. The one thing I think we do know how to do is avoid a Great Depression, because no central bank has forgotten how to print money. And for some strange reason in the 30s, they forgot this central task of the central of a central bank. So I'm pretty optimistic we can, and the Japanese have demonstrated that even with the most sensational asset price collapses, you can keep an economy going somehow. So I tend to think the purely economic catastrophe we can probably manage. Interests. Here there's really quite an optimistic story, which is perhaps related even to the protests and the protesters. In the 100 years ago, even up to actually the early post-war period, we essentially had production organized around national countries, national companies. They had the same interests as their workforce. There was, of course, no WTO, no international system to preserve liberalism. Multinational companies just don't work that way. They have internationally integrated operations. Their interests are at odds with their national workforces. They find it very, very difficult even to define what nation they belong to. I mean, is GM in China more American than Toyota in the United States? You can't answer questions like that. And that the effect of that is that as soon as you start getting serious protectionist lobbying in any country, it disintegrates, except in those industries which remain purely national. And that is why the most protected industries in the world are agriculture and steel, and to some extent, pure textiles. It has the same characteristic. And so I actually think multinationals, one of the virtues of multinationals is they make protectionist lobbying very, very hard, and I like that. There is, however, one huge risk, which is that the rise of the Asian countries is bringing about huge changes in comparative advantage, and particularly making, associated with the telecommunications revolution, far more of our service sector is tradable than ever before. There's a big middle-class anxiety associated with that. You saw it in the American presidential election. And clearly there are risks that that will lead to some form of protectionist backlash. But ultimately, I think, not much, because actually you can't really stop the tradability of things that go down the wire. And finally, ideas. Well, here I think there really is a big change. The belief in socialism, planning, and import substitution in the simple style of the mid-20th century seems to me not something that you can recover. I don't think that the set of beliefs of the protest groups take that form or could take that form. The most powerful element is the environmentalist movement, which would actually like to find some way of slowing the whole growth process down. Unfortunately or fortunately, they're not going to manage it. Generally, I think while we'll have lots of debates about how much market, how much state, how much welfare state, how we run a global system and all that, I don't think we're going to abandon the basic sense that we've got to run an economic system on the market basis. So I've just about covered this enormous range of issues in 40 minutes, a real cook's tour of this. Theme one, as I said, what we are witnessing is essentially the result of a market revolution that is overlain upon a long-standing but very powerful technological change, set of technological changes, of which the most important bit has been this convergence of telecommunications with computing that has given us, for example, the internet and everything that goes with that. Second theme I've mentioned, the thing we don't seem to be able to solve, is the relationship between markets and states and the ability to create states which are, as it were, using a phrase that now is widely bandied about, sufficiently good, quote unquote, to make markets work given the resources, the particular resources that countries possess. Third, globalization, because of its nature as I've defined it, has been particularly beneficial for countries which start off labor surplus, the classic East Asian development pattern, and it has facilitated enormously the growth process of those economies. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore were forerunners, but of course we're now seeing it spread to the continental giants, China now, India, I think, in future. And that is quite simply a sensationally important event in our lifetimes. Fourth, I've argued, if we manage our policies sensibly, it is perfectly possible for Europeans to continue to enjoy welfare states, provided the welfare states are structured reasonably, intelligently, and sensibly. It's very important to remind ourselves that some of the economies that have done best in exploiting these opportunities while sustaining the welfare state structure are the Scandinavians. Now, I'm not saying everybody can be like Sweden or Denmark, but at least it does indicate that the idea that the only way to go is to be like the United States is far too simple. And finally, we do have some huge risks in front of us. I've tried to stress some of them in sustaining not just the globalization aspect, but really the whole structure of cooperation among states. And I don't wish to understate the significance of those threats. But on the whole, I think, for the reasons I've given you, we can probably manage them. And if we can manage them, we have the chance of creating an environment in which, if we act sensibly, prudently, wisely, we can spread these opportunities to more people. The biggest challenge in that regard, of course, is sub-Saharan Africa. And with that, I think I've covered at least some of the issues in the book. I would like to stress, nonetheless, it was extremely superficial running through this book. As I said, it is 400 pages. So you need to read them all. So I encourage you to go out and buy it. And now, with that, I'm happy to answer questions, dodge bullets, and all the rest of it from anybody in the audience.
Okay, well, thank you, Martin. That was, yes, a superb overview of the facts and the issues. So we've got some time for questions. I imagine Martin needs to pause for breath.
No, apparently not. What about this gentleman? Seems very keen. That's a very big question, which I do discuss. May I separate out several issues? First, on environmental regulation, the balance of the evidence, which I've taken from a whole range of reports, seems to be quite clear that in the developing world as a whole, the general move has been also towards tighter environmental regulation. The degree of effectiveness of those regulations is always a contentious issue. As I'm sure you know, I would consider myself modestly well-informed on a number of developing countries, but they are mostly Asian countries. But in many countries, of course, there are a great many regulations which have been passed by governments which aren't enforced. So these are discussions of the regulatory regime. I'm not really competent to judge how far the enforcement of those regulations has improved or worsened across the developing world as a whole. In the case of labor regulations, the story is actually very, very complicated. It seems, as far as I can see, in the countries, well, perhaps we can separate into several components. Countries that have grown successfully over lengthy periods have certainly, without a doubt, raised the regulatory standards in labour. That's particularly true of the earlier wave of Asian success stories. Korea, for example, is a very remarkable case. Countries that remain, and they do tend to remain, labour surplus over a generation or more. This is clearly the Chinese condition. Leaving aside the politics, and the politics of China in this regard are quite obvious, the economic pressures seem to be, as I read the recent literature, very ambiguous in the sense that there's quite a lot of evidence that real wages have been rising quite rapidly in some areas of China, particularly in Shenzhen, and that obviously goes with other improvements. But in the country as a whole, is chronically labor surplus, and the supply of labor to modern industry is still infinitely elastic. So the ability to raise labor standards effectively and make it stick in a very competitive economy where regulatory efficiency is quite limited is probably close to zero. And I think where that in a labor surplus economy, they have been extremely effective in imposing regulation on the formal modern sector, which is India. They have been really effective, and unfortunately the consequence of their being really effective is that employment in the modern sector has declined for the last 35 years, so which is also a very adverse effect. So what I'm really saying is that it is possible to raise regulatory standards in labour surplus developing countries if you really want to do it, even in this sort of context. The price, however, is, I think, not so much that you lose international competitiveness per se. The price is that you exacerbate very dramatically internal dualism. And that is, I think, been a deep problem, a very deep and long-standing problem with India's development path. I have seen no clear evidence, there's a lot of controversy about it, on the argument that as a result of the movement of multinationals, the global tendency in labour regulation has been a race to the bottom, but it may be true in the export processing zones. The controversy there is quite considerable. But the big problem, I think, is the underlying economic problem, that in the context of massive labour surpluses, which remain the case in large parts of the world, shifting labour regulations effectively, particularly in countries with very, very weak administrative regimes, is just very hard. So I think it's just a very complicated question, to which part of the answer to the question is it's not absolutely clear what optimal policy is. And I discussed that at great length. Clearly, it is possible in a labour surplus, very, very poor economy, to over-regulate labour markets, and the consequences of that can be to make the position of everybody outside the regulated labour market, which is virtually everybody. In India, it's 90% of the population. Very much worse than it would otherwise be. Well, my advice is let the Norwegians run your country. This is actually a friend of mine. I know this is being facetious, but everybody knows that I noticed this first when I worked in the World Bank 25 years ago. The resource curse literature is now, of course, as you know, very, very well developed, but it's a well-known phenomenon. As a friend of mine, Paul Collier, who you may know, professor at Oxford, who is, I think, the most distinguished economist to have worked on African economics problems outside Africa in the last 25 years, says the problem with resource wealth, particularly point resource wealth, which is what you were talking about, minerals, is that managing them successfully is extremely intensive in good government. The resources come to the government, the wealth comes to the government. It's essentially independent of whatever the majority of the people do. It comes directly by the writing of checks from a very small number of international companies. The money is sensationally large, and if you can obtain a fair share of it, or an unfair share of it, you can become sensationally rich. And you will easily find banking systems in the West where it can be comfortably deposited. And that has unfortunately happened one way or the other in many resource-rich countries. There are extreme cases, probably Angola is the worst in the world, but there are many others, Nigeria and so forth. The principle, of course, of how to run these places, the fundamental problem, there are many problems with this, but the fundamental problem is that it breaks any sort of social contract. The basic social contract of a civilized society is people, citizens, work. They give taxes more or less voluntarily, tax revenues to the government. The government has to provide them services in return, because if they don't, they won't work. I mean, in essence, if the government doesn't do what it needs to do, you don't have an economy. Now, in the resource-rich countries, that doesn't apply. They get all their wealth without the people doing any work. The relationship is inverted. The people become clients of the state instead of the state being a client of the people. The dependency is completely inverted, and you get some really horrendous political problems. The only country that I know of to have had an enormous resource wealth in relationship to the wealth of the population, there are obviously lots of resource-rich countries which haven't had such huge resource rents in relation to the population, to have used it prudently, that is to say, to accumulate a huge fund which will be invested for in perpetuity to generate a permanent income for the people, which have avoided completely corrupting the political process, which has provided services to the people and all the rest of it, is Norway. And that's because it happened to a country with already extremely highly evolved institutions of democratic society and so forth, actually to a quite extraordinary degree. There are one or two other small countries that didn't do sensationally badly. Interestingly, for example, Kuwait didn't do that badly. At least they invested, they created an investment fund. There was some sort of sense of it. But in many parts of the world, it has simply been a catastrophe. What could we do about this? Well, I argued, discussed that yesterday. I think we have to be, I do now, fully, we have this extractive industry transparency initiative, which is this government is promoting, the idea being to force all multinationals to state completely and openly how much the royalty income is. In some cases, there's been a big effort, Chad is an example, to actually create a completely separate, transparent budget, which is managed to some extent outside the political process to ensure that the money is reasonably well used. Other people have argued, interestingly in the context of Iraq, that what we should do is actually hand the ownership directly to the people, so the money goes directly to people, not to the state. If the state wants the money, it has to tax them. That's very difficult to arrange. There are a whole host of radical ideas out there. What is absolutely clear is that the history of resource rent, of particularly large resource rents in the last 30 years, have been quite simply a catastrophe. And we've got this extraordinary phenomenon that the only really successful economies have been countries that are dirt poor. And that's something very deeply wrong with that. So the problem you've identified is very extreme, and the question is, can we find international systems that support to do something about this? The reason it's so difficult, of course, is that these are the governments that don't need aid. They don't need assistance. They've got money anyway. They are, in that degree, really independent. I could go on for a long time, but that seems to me the broad answer. There's a very well-known argument about this. Milton Friedman made the argument, of course, and before them it was a very economist called Clark, and I've forgotten his first name. He was here, wasn't he? It'll come to me. Anyway, there is an argument that once you get, I think Milton Friedman said, it was once you get over 30% of GDP, you've had it. The argument being that as soon as the majority of the population in a democratic society depend on income from the state, in essence, or the great majority, they will always vote for higher taxes, because it's in their interest to do so, because they're net recipients, and they will slowly kill the golden goose. It'll die, and there won't be adequate economic activity. And that's a fairly standard argument. A very similar argument was made in the British context by two British economists, Bacon and Eltis, whom people will remember, in the 70s about the need to cut back spending. First of all, answer to your question, I can't remember the exact proportion of people in Scandinavia who are directly employed by the state, but if you add those people directly employed to those people who receive their income from the state, particularly pensions, it's certainly over half. So if this analysis is correct, these countries should be suffering from collapse. And I have to say, it's an argument to which I've been quite sympathetic in the past, because I am a bit of a reactionary. But the truth is that faced with crisis, they've been rather effective in adjusting themselves to the reality, i.e., for instance, in Sweden's case, they've reduced the tax ratio, though it's still the highest in the world, by about 10 percentage points of GDP over the last 10 years because of the way they responded to the fiscal crisis of the early 90s. And in that context, they also reduced public spending even more. So it seems to me, at least the least we can say, is that in countries which seem to have rather homogeneous populations in which people are concerned for the welfare of those who are working in the private sector, who might well be their children, for example, and where there is a real concern to achieve aggregate economic performance, through what Mansur Olson called it encompassing organizations, the idea that the organizations in countries like these actually treat the wealth, the GDP, the entire GDP as the maximand, because you're all going to benefit in an encompassing organization from raising the aggregate GDP. It seems that in those contexts, you can have really very high taxes and a very high levels of dependency on the state without killing the golden goose. And God knows, it's quite clear if you look at the development of new businesses in Scandinavia, particularly in the high-tech industry, they've done extraordinarily well. There is a question of, you know, the famous line, don't try this at home. How far it is sensible for the rest of the world to behave as if they were Sweden is one of those issues that I debate with some of my friends. I don't want to push it that far, but it is important to stress that a number of the richest and most successful countries in the world are European countries with extremely high tax ratios, and they haven't collapsed yet, and we're still waiting. So I tend to think it can be done in those contexts. As I said, I wouldn't recommend it to everywhere in the world, and I certainly wouldn't recommend it to, let us say, Brazil.
Okay, let's just take one final question. I think there was one at the back some minutes ago. Yeah.
Right, well, this is a question, you wouldn't expect me to agree with this, but this is a question we could certainly spend an hour debating. Basically, I think you are wrong, but not entirely. I certainly don't wish to defend, I'm very clear this, I left the World Bank for a reason, and I'm very happy to admit the plethora of mistakes they made. But if you think about the core recommendations, let's first of all take the debt issue separately. I happen to think that default should be a reasonably normal part of a world economic system. It has actually become more normal. However, the reason that we have to separate them, the reason Latin American countries have got into the death trap and I'm going to discuss this at great length, is essentially a long history of sensationally irresponsible fiscal policy. And the reason the IMF has had so many problems is because of the long history of sensationally irresponsible fiscal policy. The same similar problems do lie behind, I think, all the, they're different because terms of trade shocks have been so severe in Africa, but many African countries got into difficulties essentially for the same reason. Now, if you start looking at the East Asian countries, what is interesting is how macroeconomically orthodox they've been. I mean, they simply haven't allowed themselves to run fiscal policy in that way. And that was one of the reasons why they managed to get out of the Asian crisis so easily. Because while they had a private sector financial crisis, which was different from that of the Latin American crises, their governments were so fiscally strong. And that made it possible for them essentially to bail out their entire financial system quite easily by raising domestic borrowing. Argentina, in essentially the same situation, couldn't do so because its fiscal debt was already so gigantic. So quite contrary to the idea that the Latin Americans in particular have been very forced to very orthodox policies, and the Asians have pursued a happy way that the IMF has ignored, the IMF has been very kind about, it's actually the reverse in my view. The Asians have been extremely orthodox, and therefore they haven't needed the IMF to do the fiscal thing. And indeed, as you probably know, in the middle of the Asian financial crisis, the IMF was vastly criticized throughout the world for insisting in fiscal tightening in countries, every one of which had a fiscal surplus already. So I think that's the difference. The second point, obviously, is the question of the nature and speed of moves to the market. It is clear that the liberalization process in China has been slow, steady. I have no problem with that as a route. It's clear about the direction. But I wouldn't describe the liberalization process in Brazil as exactly rapid. I don't think the differences in that regard are very extreme either. There are one or two Latin American countries, really only one or two, Argentina is the most important, that went through a liberalization process extremely rapidly. Personally, I do not believe, and we can argue that if you like at great length, that Argentina's difficulties have anything to do with the liberalization process. I think they have to do with the exchange rate regime, which incidentally the IMF opposed, though it later agreed that it had to support it, and it had to do with fiscal policies. Africa's problems are, I think, genuinely sui generis. I think I do think external factors are immensely important, but it's certainly not because of the reduction in protection. The simple truth is that the efforts of protection in Africa had not succeeded in creating any industries that I am aware of which were in any way internationally viable. And that's a very important problem and very different from the experience of some of the Asian countries. The big problem on the trade side in Africa has been the terms of trade problem. And that is way beyond the ability of the IMF or the World Bank to solve. It has to do with the nature of their commodity specialization and extreme difficulties of diversification. So I could go on for great length. There are many, many more things to say. I think the differences between nobody can be proud of what's happened in Latin America or Africa. And I certainly wouldn't argue that the international agencies have done a marvelous job. They clearly haven't. But saying if only they'd all behaved like China, they would all be like China, as it were, is quite honestly, I think, absolutely absurd.
Okay. Okay, clearly there are a huge number of enormously important arguments, all laid out brilliantly in the book. So let's just thank Martin again for giving us this very, very generous taster. Excellent. Thank you.